Good afternoon, ladies and gents. First of all, I should introduce myself. I'm Maggie Scammell, the Department of Media and Communications. And I'm standing in today actually for Roger Silverstone, who would have loved to have been here, but unfortunately couldn't make it. Anyway, Media LSE are absolutely delighted to be hosting this event. And before I go on to introduce John, I'd like to pay special thanks to Rosanna Chowdhury for all her hard work on this, and for Kath Bennett over there, who's worked very hard as well to get this together. And it's my pleasure to introduce John Snow. John has been the presenter of Channel 4 News since 1899, I was going to say. I don't know if it feels like that, John.
Yeah.
Since 1989. And before that, he worked on radio and for ITN and was a correspondent in Washington. And earlier still, he was a student at the University of Liverpool, where I used to work, and where he always had a revered presence. And he is not ashamed to say that he was a revolting student, and was sent down, as they say, for what the authorities, the Liverpool University authorities, called political disturbances. So it started early. Now, this, I've read through John's book, and reading it, I think I can safely say, and I was a journalist for a short while myself, he's the type of journalist, and it's the type of story that inspires people to be journalists. It's an amazing story, really, and it's there's everything in there: glamour, excitement, danger, the whole lot there. And it starts off like this. It starts off with John telling the story about he and the cameraman called Klaus Bratt, I think, John, find themselves stranded in a boat built for 30 people, packed with 300 Vietnamese refugees, looking for somewhere to land, finding themselves on the coast of Malaysia. They land, they get set upon, they get beaten up, and he gets dumped in a cell. And that's not for the last time that he gets dumped in a cell. John has reported from the battlegrounds of Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan. He's reported from the battlegrounds of Latin America, Nicaragua and El Salvador, and from Africa, Ethiopia and Angola. He's been there at so many of the great events of history. The falling of the Berlin Wall, Nelson Mandela's walk to freedom. He's interviewed many of the great leaders, Mandela himself, Gorbachev, and this keeps coming up on his website in any biography of John, Monica Lewinsky. That seems to be one of the great stories. The book is a personal history. It's John's story and his take on the great events of recent history. But it's also, I think, one of the most interesting things for me, it's a very sharp insight into, if you like, the press gang. And the often extremely seductive and I imagine John thinks corrupting power of being so close to the corridors of power and working in them every day. He's got, all you Channel 4 News watchers will know that John does have a political viewpoint. He is upfront about it. and he's critical not just of politicians very often, but also of the media themselves. And the book ends up with some sharp criticism of the media and how in our increasingly globalized world we get less and less important news of the world and increasingly confined to our own popular culture of Pop Idol and EastEnders. He's won many awards for his reporting from the hotspots and has twice been given the Television Presenter of the Year award. I think it's twice, twice. I don't know if there's a third one. Channel 4 News' distinctiveness and loyal and continuing popularity owes absolutely massively to Jon Snow. So John's going to talk now for about 15, 20 minutes. We'll open it up for questions. I've told him that that I sometimes ask horrible questions if I'm allowed to. He's encouraged them, and he wants horrible and tough questions. And then there'll be a book signing more or less about 2 o'clock. John will be signing books, and I've had instructions for what to tell people who want to get a signed copy of the book, and I can't remember what they were. Hang on, I'm getting conflicting instructions. Oh right, buy a book out there and come around here and queue up, and John will sign it. Okay, thanks very much, John.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, it's very nice to be back. I haven't actually been here into this particular place since 1982, when I was invited to come and address the LSE El Salvador Solidarity Society. And the flame-haired temptress who was in charge of the proceedings was somebody called Kirsty Lang, then a student at this place. And then I subsequently eventually ended up doing Channel 4 News with her. She would sit there and I would sit here. Alas, she's gone to the BBC now. But so it's very, very nice to be back, and I have very fond memories of being here. This book was inspired by the Iraq War, because I thought that in the Iraq War and in the build-up to it lay all the signals and evidence that nobody had learned any lessons from the past, and that many, many of the issues that I had had to rake through in the 30 years that I've vaguely been on the road, in a sense, came to a head with the war in Iraq. And I think that was also true for many people, you know, across the country and indeed elsewhere in the world who thought about it. They just felt, we've been here before and somebody has made a grotesque miscalculation about what we're really dealing with. And so I thought it would be interesting to write a book which kind of tracked how we got to where we are. But inevitably it was going to be a very personal take, because there are places I have never worked. I've never worked in Brazil. I've never worked in China. I've worked in Hong Kong, but in those days it wasn't China. So it was obviously going to be a slightly myopic book, but on the other hand, as Maggie suggested, it's trodden around through some of the sort of key moments in the last 30 years of history. So in a way, it's a kind of potted, accessible history with a few jokes. And it's also some polemic, too, which fortunately my editor hated the book so much that he didn't, as my employer hated the book so much, he didn't bother to get to the polemic bits and therefore didn't cut them out. So it's an angry book in some ways, too. I was born into extremely privileged white Southern English stock. My grandfather went to the relief of Khartoum as a subaltern in the late 19th century. My father was a bishop and had taught at Eton. And he was the headmaster of a minor public school in Sussex, where I was born in the aftermath of the Second World War. And I can remember from my bedroom window looking out and seeing the steam trains running across the viaduct between London and Brighton in the middle of the Sussex green and pleasant lands. And into this sort of sheltered experience, one day when my father had taken me, as was compulsory, to evensong at the back of the chapel, there sat a very old man, a strange man I hadn't seen before. He looked like this. And after the service, my father said, "John, I want to introduce you to the Prime Minister, Mr. Harold Macmillan." And I shook his hand, and he said, "Do you know what a Prime Minister is, young man?" And I said, "Are you something to do with the Queen?" And he said, "No, I am a politician, and I run the country. Perhaps you'd like to be a politician one day." And with that, he got into his large Humber and purred away to his country residence just up the road. Little did I know that this poor unhappy man who sat at the back of the chapel on numerous occasions on Sunday evenings was there because his wife Dora was carrying on a torrid affair with a rogue of a Tory backbencher called Bob Boothby, who Macmillan finally got his comeuppance on, who eventually managed to get his own back on by ennobling him. One of the most useless men ever to sit in the House of Commons was delivered of a peerage, and of course everybody wondered what on earth he had done to deserve a peerage. Nowadays you never ask that question because peerages aren't worth a bag of salt, and they weren't then either. But anyway, there it was. He got his peerage, and poor old Harold was there because there was no one to go home to, and so he came and sat amongst us in the chapel of Ardingly College. Well, so that was my sort of first introduction to politics, I suppose. And for a long time, I really did want to be a Tory MP. It seemed to me to be a good life. Nice car, quiet engine, and good eyebrows. And so, and really, that was the sort of progress I made through my boarding school and the rest of it. I was a bit of a dunderhead academically. But anyway, whilst I was at school, and I don't really know why, I sort of hatched this feeling that I would like somehow to find a passport out of England and go somewhere. And I applied for voluntary service overseas. And I had never been on a plane. I had never been physically out of England, not even to Scotland. We always went to the same stretch of Studland Beach in Dorset every summer and built sandcastles until I was 15, long past sandcastle building. But they became very elaborate, and we set fire set fire to them and made ball castles and the rest of it and timed the ball from the top. At any rate, I suddenly found myself with a letter in my hand saying, "You have been selected and are due to go to Uganda next week." And that's exactly what happened. I got onto a very old British Overseas Airways VC-10 and clattered off to Rome, feeling very claustrophobic, landed in Tripoli, and eventually arrived at Entebbe. At the end of the airport, there was at the end of the runway, there was a very tumble-down old priest, and he was my transport 270 miles into the bush. I arrived at a place that was 15 miles from the nearest post box, had no telephone, had no radio contact, but was on the sublime banks of the River Nile, about 70 miles north of the lake of Lake Victoria. And there I felt grievously homesick. There were two other white people in the entire set up, and they were both priests. I wasn't, but they were. And they were Catholic priests at that. And one was Dutch, and the other came from Leeds and was the tumble-down creature that I'd met at the airport. He was a Dickensian figure of ferocious characteristics. Otherwise, there was the school. And I had a class of about 70 kids, some of whom were older than I was, because they'd had to work to earn the money to go to school at all. And one day I was writing on the blackboard, and somebody made a rude noise behind me, and I turned around and said, "Who was that?" And the girl in the front row said, "That black boy at the back, sir." And I said, "But you're all black." And she said, "Ah, sir, some of us are much blacker than others." And I looked, and I suddenly realized he was the most beautiful blue-black Nilotic boy from the Sudanese border, that she herself was a rather creamy cappuccino from southwest Uganda, and the whole room, in fact, of course, came alive with all kinds of characteristics and differences, and I began, of course, to connect with an altogether different world. So this very homesick boy of 18, by the time he was 19 and ready to come back, really was looking for absolutely any which way to stay, and stay for the rest of my life, as far as I was concerned. It was a complete love affair with Africa, and of course completely radicalized me. I arrived back with no place to go to university. One of the reasons I'd thought of going on VSO was that my A-levels were so bad that I thought that if I applied to university from the bush, they'd say, "What a courageous and sort of special sort of chap. Why don't we... yes, of course, we must take him." And instead, I just got endless rejection slips. So I, in fact, went to Tavistock Square, where the clearing depot was. You weren't never supposed to turn up in person, but it wasn't computerized or anything. That was all on cards. And so I went round there, and I said, "Look, come on, I've got to go to university, and I don't mind where it is. I don't even mind what course it is." And my father had met a bloke on a train who claimed to be the professor of law at Liverpool University. And I asked them whether there was a law place at Liverpool University, and they said there is, but there's not a chance of you getting it. You've got a better chance of reading chemistry at Sheffield. But I couldn't possibly read chemistry. I hadn't got any kind of scientific qualification, whatever. But anyway, I got on the train and went to Liverpool and banged on the guy's door and said, look, you know, I've got terrible A-laws, but I am interesting. And he took me on. He took me on. And this, of course, was a dreadful, terrible thing for him, because it all ended in the most terrible tears, because, of course, I'd arrived there now full of anger and fury. Biafra was raging in West Africa, the civil war in Nigeria. Apartheid was absolutely at its height. And, of course, there was the illegal UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence, in Rhodesia. So that we were not short of causes, plenty of causes, in which, of course, every British politician was in the wrong, except Fenner Brockway. I mean, there were very few British politicians that any of us looked up to. But at any rate, of course, it was 1968, so we were feeling a little bit chastened for not being revolting enough. I mean, everybody else seemed to be having a good time on campus, but we weren't. But at any rate, I mean, it did strike me as quite incredible to discover that the chancellor of this institution was a chap called Lord Salisbury. Lord Boppety Salisbury was indeed the great-grandson of the so-called founder of Rhodesia, though how one founds a country that already exists, I don't know, or indeed a place that already had its own culture and civilization and Zimbabwe Towers and all the rest of it. However, there he was at 87, the Chancellor of Liverpool University, and a self-declared racist. I mean, it wouldn't be too cruel to say that he was certainly not enlightened on that front. And we felt it was not a good idea for a liberal institution like Liverpool University to have a chancellor like that. Now that I am myself a university chancellor at Oxford Brookes, I now feel somewhat vulnerable to all this. But anyway, we decided he had to go. And because I had a public school accent, it was felt that I might be the one person who might be able to communicate with him, because that he might not easily take the regional accents that then dominated Liverpool University. So I was dispatched with my long hair, my Afghan coat, my open-toed sandals, my beads, down to Lime Street Station to encounter and intercept Lord Salisbury. And there he was, tumbling off the train, with a retinue, and possibly a detached retina to boot. I don't know. He didn't seem to see well. But at any rate, I said to him, my lord, I'm here from the Students' Union, and I have a message for you. No, sounding remarkably like Harold Wilson, to whom Harold Macmillan, to whom he was distantly related. Don't talk to me here. Come and have tea. And this rather strange, bedraggled crocodile of butler, valet, long-haired widow in Afghan coat traipsed along the platform 4 at Liverpool Lime Street Station to the Adelphi Hotel. And we sat in the sort of marble-pillared sort of dining room and took tea. China tea, bone china cups, crustless cucumber sandwiches, all rather good. And the old lord and I began to get on rather well. We talked about Africa and the rest of it. And I began to sort of feel the will to assassinate the man seeping away. And then I suddenly sort of looked up at one of these huge marble columns, and I thought, God, one of those trots maybe down from the campus and spot me taking tea with the tyrant. I must stiffen up. And so I said, my lord, I'm sorry, but, you know, I have now got to tell you that you must not come onto the campus. There will be a riot if you come onto the campus. Oh, well, very well, I shan't come. And furthermore, Mr. Snow, I have to tell you, I shall never come again. In fact, I've never liked coming in the first place. And I thought, well, that was unsurprising. Liverpool was a slightly grimy place, even if throbbing to the beat of Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers and the rest of it. And there he was, you know, he got on the train and disappeared again. And I felt really a bit of a heel, really, because he was rather old and collapsed and disintegrated. But anyway, of course, I went back to the campus, a complete hero, and first-class honours, Stalin star, trot in the badge, and all the rest of it, and very quickly found myself on the stage discussing what else the university had to do to comply with our wishes, one of which was to disinvest their huge investments from apartheid South Africa. Being a Tate and Lyle city, Liverpool, The university was completely enthralled to Tate and Lyle. All their investments were wrapped up in Tate and Lyle's South African interests. So we said, you know, that's all going to have to go. It's going to have to change. And, of course, they said, you're students, here today, gone tomorrow. You've got nothing to do with our investments. Bugger off. But we didn't. We occupied instead. And for six balmy weeks, we occupied the then brand new Senate block. And we had people like Robin Blackburn, who was then a radical lecturer here, come up and teach in the alternative university that we ran in the Senate block. It was heaven. It was utopia. And, of course, it was completely meaningless. It meant nothing to anybody except ourselves. But it was revolting. I was elected to the students' union body, as were the other 10 people who were deported from the place. We were all put before a kangaroo court of professorial staff, found guilty and dispatched. And then the wonderful professor of law, who still lives and is still amongst us, John Griffith, came up at his own expense on a train to defend us in our appeal and managed to get my sentence commuted from permanent expulsion to 1 year, because I had seen to it that the lavatories and the rest of the public areas of the Senate block had been returned to the authorities in a clean condition. So that, I'm afraid, at the age of 21 was my main claim to fame. But I had been deported out of the university, and I was, of course, now I didn't have the ideology. I wasn't a Marxist or anything like that. I was a pinko liberal, and I was really gutted. I mean, it was a messy thing to be. I mean, a student with nowhere to go. And I came to work in a place at the back here, in Macklin Street off Drury Lane, which was a day centre for homeless teenagers. And oddly enough, it was a place to which the social science people here were sending placements, etc. So there was a sort of early connection with LSE. But anyway, very quickly I discovered I was better at talking about it than doing it. I found it emotionally very draining. But I stayed there for about 3 years. And then got a job on radio, and then a job in television. And then, of course, the great thing was that one day somebody came into the newsroom and said, has anyone been to Uganda? And I was the only person to put his hand up. And the reason I had to go to Uganda was that Jim Callaghan, the then foreign minister, was going to go and rescue a pretty odd British lecturer who decided to write a book about Idi Amin. And I had got to know Idi Amin when I had been a teacher. Idi Amin had a passion for boxing and killing and lots of other things, but boxing was what I was aware of at that stage. I wasn't aware of the killing at that stage. And I was sent with Jim Callaghan, and the reason I got to know old Amin through boxing was that I had to drive the school boxing team. I mean, boxing was a complete anathema to me, but the team were rather sweet. And so I had to drive them to Kampala for the National Boxing Championships, and who should be refereeing the National Boxing Championships but none other than Field Marshal Idi Amin Dada in the ring. And, of course, Amin's view of boxing was that refereeing involved basically finishing off the fight himself. But anyway, he was very intrigued by me because I was so tall. He said, you're very tall for a white man. Your mother must have eaten much pawpaw. I said, poor old mum had never seen a pawpaw in her life. You know, Waitrose didn't exist in those days. To cut a long story short, that sort of gave me a passport into being a kind of foreign correspondent, and I trekked around. And this book, in a way, is the product of all that. But I felt that in writing it, one should explain a bit who one was before one lugged anybody off on a journey, particularly one that might be rather controversial. But I suppose the real theme that threads through it is the role America plays in our international relationships. And I mean, you're seeing it acted out in Uzbekistan. I mean, an absolutely stunning, extraordinary story about which we still don't know really the details. And yet, I mean, there's dear old George standing up saying, you know, freedom, democracy, let a thousand springs bloom, or whatever it is. And anyway, good suspension. But in all that stuff, and of course, you get a tyrant who people try to rebel against. The tyrant says that the people who are rebelling are all Muslim extremists and that he is entirely in favor of the war on terror. And so he and the United States are allied in order to facilitate an air base that the United States have against what's going on in Afghanistan, etc., etc. And you find yourselves in some way lashed to something which isn't quite right. I mean, clearly this guy has a very, very long history of extremely unpleasant activity and not somebody we should probably be doing a great deal of business with, although Britain did indeed sign an arms deal with Uzbekistan as recently as 2 years ago. So these are the sort of constant problems one is wrestling with, and the book attempts to kind of have a go at some of that. Anyway, I think I should answer some questions, because I haven't talked about anything relevant at all. I've only talked about strange middle-class English upbringings that deteriorated into rebellion. And the only rebellion I have now is my tie. I mean, basically, one day they said, you're the dullest thing on the set. And I thought, well, I'm not going to spend a lot of money on suits, so I'll wear a tie. And they said, you can't wear bright colours on television. I thought, great, I'll wear bright colours on television. So there it is. And that's the only rebellion that continues. I mean, so it just shows you, we all become sort of establishment rejects, you know, by the end. So why don't we throw it open to some questions, because we could get something intelligent going instead of the sort of flim-flam that I've offered you so far. Anybody got any thoughts that they'd like to exercise? There are my... Yes, sir. Thank goodness for you.
Thank you. You mentioned en passant about what your worries about the way the media is going in this country, and where's ethics in the mix these days. Would you like to elaborate a little bit more about your feelings in that respect and the things that you think could happen in order to change the situation?
Yes, I mean, the thing is, I don't think there really is any great conspiracy to kind of dumb down or, reduce things to their sort of most banal. But there are lots of pressures which have dawned. And in a way, I feel I've been very, very lucky to be in on the period, particularly of electronic journalism, television journalism, in a way which was at its best. I mean, at its best, we had masses of time. When I was first sent to Africa, you could go somewhere and you could tell the foreign desk that you were going to spend the day perhaps, going after Idi Amin or whatever and trying to sort of piece together how he was functioning and what sort of repression was being practiced and all the rest of it. And then, you'd send a telex when you got back to the hotel saying, we've got rather a good piece. We think it'll amount to maybe 4 minutes on News at 10 tonight. There's a plane at 3 tomorrow afternoon which gets into Heathrow at 6 o'clock the next morning. We're now talking 2 days later, and the package will be on the flight, and that would mean that once it had been through the chemical laboratory, because it would be film, it would be ready to go on air 3 days after we shot it. And in the meantime, we could possibly re-script it, we could bring in new elements, and this, that, and the other. And so quite a thoughtful piece could possibly make the air 3 days later. Well, now, I mean, you're not sent anywhere anyway that you don't have immediate communication from. And so not only are you under great pressure to deliver very quickly, but you're also under great pressure because people back at base are reading what other people are doing in the country that you happen to be in. And they will say to you, I see that there's a football match in Genghis Khan land, which happens to be only, 800 miles from where you happen to be. It is in the same country, but it's not actually anywhere near where you are, and it's not relevant to the story that you're going to. We'd awfully like a bit of that as well, et cetera, et cetera. So there is all that. There is the sort of downside of mass communication, which exerts great pressure on the people on the ground. But there's also the fact that in fact, of course, they don't send anybody anywhere anyway now at all. In fact, the war was a sort of very aberrant thing. And indeed, I think a lot of people were only sent on the war because governments said, here, come along, we're going to embed you. So there was great pressure to find people, most of whom had never been in a war in their lives. I mean, in many ways, it made their reporting very interesting. But generally speaking, the desire to send people, it's very expensive. You get the pictures anyway. You can send somebody down the corridor to an edit suite and they can get the Reuters copy and talk to a few people at the LSE. And Bob's your uncle, you've got a piece. So it's not the same as sending one pair of eyes on your behalf to experience as a human being some small slice of what's happening that perhaps informs your wider take on the whole thing. I mean, people blame viewing figures and all that. I don't believe they're anything to do with it. The number of editorial meetings I've been in where people have said, oh, the viewers won't be interested in that. You really don't want to be wasting time with that. You know, where for example, you take, we had a poll that Reuters conducted last Christmas. What do you think is the most unreported conflict in the world? And of course, the Democratic Republic of Congo came top. What efforts have we really made to report the war in the Congo? What real efforts have mainstream television, or indeed mainstream anything else, made to really get to the bottom of what's going on in Congo, what has been going on for the past few years? Well, of course, when you discover that if I wanted to get a story out of Kinshasa tonight, the satellite communication alone would cost $2,500. And if I want to hear Gorgeous George talking to the Senate tonight, I can get it for $110. Am I going to take Gorgeous, or am I going to go and do a worthy piece on the prospects for peace in the Democratic Republic of Congo? I can't have both. It's going to be an either-or, because there's only going to be 17% of the bulletin devoted to foreign news anyway. And Gorgeous counts as foreign news because the Washington correspondent will have to do it. These banal sort of, you know, judgments are what lead to what ends up on the screen in the mainstream news output. And then, of course, the other thing is that news as entertainment is the real thing of the moment. It's got to have an entertainment factor. And so, as you said, Maggie, I mean, things like Pop Idol are become mainstream news matters. I mean, you know, some particular death in a soap opera or whatever is actually reported on the mainstream news. Or even the winner of, you know, one of these Big Brother type things. I mean, that they, in the great scheme of things, of course they are news, and there must be a way in which to recount these things for people for whom they are extremely important. But they're not things in the end which are going to affect the weft and weave of one's economic, political, and cultural well-being, but perhaps they are. I don't know. Maybe I am old-fashioned. Maybe, in fact, my own priorities are completely wrong. But our experience, in fact, on Channel 4 News is that actually foreign news sells. Actually, people do, in fact, rather find it quite interesting. Would like more from the Gaza Strip. Would like more from Latin America, where there is actually... Does Latin America exist? Wouldn't one love to draw a map of what exists for mainstream television news? Bolivia? When did we last cover Bolivia? You know, Ecuador? Ecuador, amazing story. I happened to go there because my daughter was doing a gap project there, and I discovered the president just sacked the entire Supreme Court because he needed to pardon the four predecessors who'd all been drummed out of the country for corruption, but all controlled various political interests in the country. And he needed them back in play to provide him support to survive. So he sacked all 32 members of the High Court and the Supreme Court and put in a whole lot of cronies. And the funny thing was he hadn't worked out that you had to be a doctor of law to be on these courts. And so they went round buying up all the last doctorates of law they could find in order to get these people sorted out. But there was a story which will never make it on the air. Sorry, yes. Hello. Your turn.
Hi, John.
How are you, darling? Are you still working for Mexican...
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness me. They're everywhere.
I was just going to say, being a foreign correspondent,
Hola.
Being from Latin America, being your old chum and colleague, do you find that it's very much that interests have taken over everywhere? I mean... You cannot place a story nowadays if there isn't an interest of the country that is paying the money for about. And it works both ways, John, because, I mean, in Mexico, the United Kingdom used to make the news as an interesting item because it had something to offer.
Like now, the royal family.
Well, okay, it could have been maybe
si.
The royal family. But on the other hand, Now, the on the other way here, if you have no British interests, you don't make it to the agenda here. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that, you know, news is not what you and I used to know was before.
I think the interesting thing about globalization is that, in fact, you know, the opportunity and the possibility of discovering more and more about the world we live in exists now in a way it never has existed before, but horizons are limiting all the time, and it's largely because still predominantly white men sitting in small rooms in television companies think that they know what people want to watch, and that what they want to watch is things about themselves, and things which affect the supermarket shelves in their local town are more interesting. Consumerism is the thing, consumerist stuff. So I don't know, but it's not a remorselessly bad scene. I mean, lots of really fantastic stuff is being done on telly even now, and we still have a better system than most other countries on earth. It's just that we ought to think about it. Yeah. The Hutton Report. Well, there's an interesting thing. This is all off the record, of course. I think the Hutton Report is extraordinary because I think the actual conduct of the report, of the investigation, the actual business, was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It was so fantastically open. We saw these people coming and going, sitting, giving their testimony and all the rest of it, and old Hutton himself, the occasional grunt, one or two sort of interesting, slightly acerbic questions, and then we got a great load of paper, which seemed to bear absolutely no relation to what we'd heard in the investigation. So the Hutton Report, I would say, somewhat odd, process, rather good. Yes. Hasn't yet been fulfilled. I like that. Early ambition to be a conservative politician. No, politician has not yet been fulfilled. I don't think I'd deny that I'm politically motivated, and I have an argument that, in fact, I think many of the best journalists, not that I would count myself as one of the best, but many of the best journalists are politically motivated. I mean, I think in the end you've got to wake up in the morning and say, shit, really? We've got to find out why. I think unless things annoy you, upset you, make you laugh, make you cry, then I don't think in the end you're going to be terribly interesting. Journalism is a fantastic trade, there's no question at all, and you wield disgusting influence in a way. People really do think you know something, and of course you know absolutely nothing at all. I know absolutely no more than anyone else in this room. In fact, quite a lot less, because there are elements of your academic studies that I could not get anywhere near. But I regret it. I regret not doing something that feels tangibly and socially more useful. And yet I enjoy what I do beyond anything I could imagine doing. So, I do think the brightest and the best should go into politics. And I think there may be some evidence that that hasn't exactly been happening.
I think I would like to amuse the people a little bit, slightly related to your work, because I work with 147,000 Gujaratis and I lived in the camp. Do I need that? I don't think so. But
Gujaratis in Uganda.
Yes, 147. Yes. But what I wanted to say, I would like you to answer to that I belong to Tripura State, which was never ruled by British. Mm. I'm the only one here. Do you know the name of Tripura?
I don't.
Okay.
And I feel
now, at the foot of Mount Everest, which is very regrettable, because
Where is it exactly?
It is at the foot of Mount Everest, in the range of Sikkim, Bhutan, Nepal, and Manipur.
I've been to Nainital and to up those sort of places up there.
Yes, it is the most fascinating, and the national movement of India and the independence of India originated from there. And the capital, which was removed from Calcutta side, which undivided Bengal, used to belong to Tripura State. Actually, that's my state. I'm Dr. Maharaj Guru Kumari of Tripura State. actually originated from there. Now, my question to you, that as you have met the president, I mean, we did not know about his the boxing part of it, but I had the privilege of meeting. You have an uncanny resemblance with Peter Shaw, who was my friend. And you look very, very much older in the television.
Oh, dear. No,
you tell something about the makeup. And also, I did not know that you are so amusing in your lecture.
Ah.
Because it was very uninteresting what you do in the television. Oh. I want you.
So I'm old,
I want something more interesting.
I need one more.
I want more interesting program. And would you kindly say something actually about, I mean, in relation to the Ugandans, because I dealt with, I'm still dealing with.
Yeah.
And our main interest of my family, 900 years, I worked with Martin Luther, Jackson, and I'm a freedom fighter. All these things I did not say as a publicity, because Tripura is not known. I want you to make it known to the people.
Tripura. Right. Good. Okay, well, you've done a lot because you've politicized 250 people in here. And we are going to see to it that we talk about it, find out about it. We're going to go to the website. Have you informed the website?
I did
not. No, well, I think that is a thing to do. That is a thing to do, a Tupra website.
I'm not interested in the website.
I like it. You want life, not some feeble manifestation of it presented by some elderly crone on the television who does nothing but bore the pants off you with tedious references to places none of us ever want to go. Right. Yes.
In the media, and obviously you're so passionate about what is happening in our world and you care, that could you, instead of going into politics, and you obviously have a love of the journalistic work that you do, could you not use the medium that you're already in to bring much more positive change? Could you not use your position and influence to start?
Could you not? Well, I mean, first of all, I think we have to be very bashful and careful about abusing our position. Enough of us abuse our positions in the media as it is. I think the problem actually genuinely is actually putting a program like Channel 4 News on the air is actually a bit of a graft. You know, you're in there from 9:30 in the morning sorting it out, and they've let me out, but I'll have to be back. And that doesn't leave much time to do much else. But I did. That's what I did with the book, to be honest. The book, I found a liberating experience, and I genuinely think if anybody bothers to read it, which I don't imagine they will, but if anybody does, that it will kind of, you know, trigger something, and we can make music together. But it doesn't need me. It needs us. That's what we need, is a lot of us, more engaged, more us. Where am I?
There's one
at yes, at the LSE, yes. Well, what can be done? I mean, I do think one of the reasons why we have a good media is, in fact, because we have a regulatory system, not a censoring system, but a regulatory system. Without a regulator, Channel 4 wouldn't have an hour of television news every night, but the regulator insists that has to happen. And I think that's a rather good thing. And I mean, the BBC is also regulated. Some people complain about the whole idea of regulating, but in a market of very different opportunities, to have several regulated outputs, I think, is actually healthy, because it means that you can safeguard things. Actually, in fact, if you really test Channel 4, they love Channel 4 News, because whenever anybody ever says, "Oh, that nudity the other night," they'll say, "But we make Channel 4 News." And it was, they offset all the sort of Big Brother and the rest of it by saying they make, you know, very good quality news programs. So we are the fig leaf for much naughtiness and fun. My dear, I'm so flattered you should be in the audience at all.
Good, I'm so glad. Well, as you know, I'm a great fan of Channel 4 News, and I think, as presenter of Channel 4 News, you have a lot of power.
Now, enough of this flannel.
We're
great admirers of the work you've done.
But leaving that aside, one of my big preoccupations with all news is that they tend to focus either on the actions of politicians or on violent episodes which are newsworthy. And as somebody who goes to war zones and talks to civil society groups, by which I don't mean NGOs, I mean local women's groups, students' groups, human rights groups, and who are debating what's happening on the ground, one of my preoccupations is why that doesn't come across in the news, because I think we could do much better in solving many of these problems if we actually knew what people are thinking on the ground. But that somehow doesn't seem to make news.
Well, but except that, I mean, the internet has made an absolutely fantastic difference. And it has also even made television very slightly more interactive. And that's a good thing. And I mean, I think what we're seeing in is the evolution of eventual fusion between television and the net, and the real possibility that we will hear more from real people and a real engagement by real people with people in power and with people who attempt to transmit accounts of what's going on. And so I'm extremely optimistic. I think we're going through a trough at the moment while the software and the hardware begin to sort out how they're going to be and what we're going to have in 10 years' time. What will it actually be that we will engage with in terms of retrieving our information? And that can only be a good thing for democracy and the rest of it. I mean, it is incredible, really. You can start something on the web like a wildfire. I mean, you can attract movements, you can attract votes, you can attract engagement. I mean, I think this has got to be the last general election in Britain when absolutely no account was paid to global warming. It simply wasn't an issue. Nothing green happened in this general election, despite the 270,000 votes that the Green Party managed to assemble. But basically, there was no debate between anybody about the environment and about the desecration of the world in which we live. And it is in a catastrophic condition. And we're building towards a tipping point beyond which we have no idea what will actually happen. You can't really compute. Brilliant piece 2 weeks ago in the New Yorker I would bring to your attention, written by a man who'd been to Fairbanks, Alaska, heartland of George Bush's desire to open the new frontier for further oil exploration. This article was one of the most devastating reads that I've had in recent years, 20 pages of the most extraordinary and harrowing journey. Points in the middle of Fairfax, a developed town, semi-city in Alaska, where the stench of burning rubber, which was how he described it, of the permafrost melting and the ground beneath heating up, was so strong that people were wearing masks, where he describes things catching fire, natural burning of newly exposed ground that heats up very fast. This is in a place which has had a solid ice cap. You know, within 20 years, we'll be able to go by boat any summer. Forget the Northwest Passage. You'll be able to sail right across the North Pole. I mean, that can't be right. We've got to sort it out. We've got to think about it. We've got to work on it. And we can't be doing interviews with ministers of the Crown who say we've got 20 years before we need to make up our minds about global warming. So, and yet, if you go to the net, the activity on that front is extraordinarily engaged and extraordinarily well-informed and very active. So I am an optimist. It may be rocky at the moment, but if we go for it, we can get it.
Yes, Duncan, I'll ask you to cast your
trouble.
Eyes, cast
trouble.
Your eyes left. No,
left.
We will be
right
soon.
The back there,
there's
sorry.
Been a couple of questions.
Sorry, yeah. I was very often one forgets up, but I never never forget the left.
Hi, good afternoon. You were a rebel in your youth, which is not too long ago. What do you think of...
Rabid, old, bad-looking on telly, full of boring stuff. Yes, rabid, yes.
What do you think of George Galloway? Do you think he's a real rebel? And do you think he got fair coverage in the British press over the past few days?
George, for anybody with a long memory, is a complex figure. I think he is a very interesting weave of saint, madman, badman, enthusiast. It would be very, very difficult to compartmentalize him. But just as there's a bit of a smell of burning rubber in Alaska, there's often a smell of burning rubber when George is around. What gives rise to the burning rubber, I don't know, or even the smell of it. But he's hard to compartmentalize. And I think it's very, very difficult to get precisely to grips. That was a grim campaign in Bethnal Green. For all sorts of reasons, not necessarily down to him, but it was quite. And if you went down there, it was quite a nasty atmosphere. And I don't know. I mean, George has always been a controversial figure. In many ways, he did great good in bringing a lot of stuff to the fore on Iraq when nobody else was talking about it. But equally, you know, there are other matters, as they say. But he's a very litigious fellow, and always successfully.
John, it's almost two, and I know a lot of people will have to...
To go, yes, to actually get on with some work.
To remind everyone that John will be sitting here signing books...
Shall we just take two quickies?
We can, if you're happy to do that, but some folk might...
But two quick questions to finish off with. Right, real fiery stuff. Yes, in the front row, you look fiery. Yeah. Ah, well, thank you for reading in such detail. I did try to establish a world record for sitting on the toilet, which I think lasted 24 hours. But the Guinness Book of Records wouldn't take it. They said it was a tasteless exercise, though I've seen lots more tasteless things than that. A remaining ambition, I think, actually genuinely, to try to engage as many people in a debate and in action on global warming. I mean, that is certainly, I must say, rather innocently and naively, my new passion. I think that it is a far graver risk to us and all our children and grandchildren than any amount of terrorism. I'm afraid I think terrorism is a pinprick by comparison to the threat posed by carbon emissions. Yes, you are going to have the last question. Oh.
What kind of Faustian bargain do you think Blair made with Bush? I mean, those two are very
strange. That goes to the nub, all right.
Bedfellows.
What kind of Faustian bargain did Blair make with Bush? I think that in the aftermath of 9/11, I think the Downing Street take, I think, was that the United States had taken it very badly, and that anything could happen, and that what was most probable was that they would hit what they could hit, and what they could hit, they thought, was Iraq. And I think that Blair thought, first of all, I think he made a journey, to be absolutely honest himself, I think he thought initially, we must keep with the Americans, because if we let them go on their own, all sorts of trouble. And I think he really thought that in some way he could be a restraining or tillering influence. And then I think that he then began to believe himself passionately in the Pentagon White House view of actually the project of democratizing the Middle East and all the rest of it. And I think he was surrounded by people who joined in that endeavor, Sir David Manning and others. I think the Foreign Office had a completely different take. They knew a lot about Iraq. They were never with the war. And Elizabeth Wilmshurst's resignation, I think, was reflected, actually, the resignation of the entire Foreign Office, if only they'd had the guts to do it. I'd really never met anybody who in the Foreign Office who really thought the war was a brilliant idea. Jeremy Greenstock downwards. I mean, I think anybody who lived in the real world did not really see it as something which was going to make out. I went to a lecture the other night given by Philippe Sands, who's professor of international law at the rival establishment along the road here, King's. And he gave a lecture which really nailed it. You know, the whole business of the illegality of the war. And the lecture was attended by Lord Bingham, the Lord Chief Justice, and at least 30 other High Court, Appeal Court, and Law Lord judges. It was a legal moment, a legal event. And it, for me, confirmed what I had been told by several senior lawyers that I am acquainted with, a former law lord and others, that actually the legal establishment in this country was completely certain that the war was illegal. And they only ever did find two people who would really put their names to the legality of it, one of whom, of course, is a very esteemed colleague here at the London School of Economics, and whom one pays great obeisance for his courage and clarity. But nevertheless, the overwhelming sense is that it was illegal, and that most of our judges are certain of that. And I think we may yet see some very, very interesting case law evolve in this country. We don't know. I mean, there are a lot of cases running at the moment, a lot of judicial reviews. And the interesting thing, I'll just tell you last thing, sorry to bore you, but I had one moment, you know, one moment that every hack yearns for in his life, and that was the arrival of a brown envelope in my house in which was a 3-page summary of the legal advice. I mean, I had worked a long time to try to get it, and I don't in fact know exactly how I did get it. It did come. And as far as I know, it is the only thing, the only copy that did come. I don't even believe the BBC actually had a copy. I think they took it off our website. Libel, bastard, why say that? But it's just, you know, we've never seen what it was they had, and nor have we ever been told who actually was given it. Therefore, I challenge them to produce it and to prove that they had another source. But anyway, there it is. The interesting thing about this this material was that it kind of set out in such good terms, you know, the pluses and the minuses of the whole business of going to war. And funny thing is that I would have got it 6 weeks earlier, but my source turned up their copy of the full account from the Attorney General. And when they read it again, they hadn't read it since the time when it had been relevant. When they read it, they thought it such a damning document in terms of Britain's own national interests. They didn't mind damning Blair or anything like that, but they thought it such a damning document that it might actually land people in court, prosecuted, possibly the International Criminal Court, etc. And they panicked and decided not to let it go. Eventually, you know, whatever happened, I don't know, but 6 weeks later I did get it. But I think that document possibly will, be material that will make a legal case. So I don't think the story's not over yet. There's still a lot more to come. It's a very interesting time to be around. A good time to be a hack, a good time to be a student at the LSE, good time to be a member of staff at the LSE, good time to be the director of the LSE, and a good time to be Maggie, and the very pleasant and kind way that she's chaired these proceedings. So I'd like to thank you very warmly and wish you Godspeed.